Chapter 21. Over the months of January and February, the Social Service Department reports the distribution of more than 800 articles to 165 families in 12 villages. Among the articles distributed were 72 beds, 8 mattresses, 16 armoires, 9 tables, 60 chairs, 28 buffets, 238 sheets, 138 blankets, 91 quilts, 10 stoves, and 118 articles of clothing. These distributions are relief work unrelated to supplies sold from the store. The sale of supplies in January and February amounted to $3,264, approximately two-thirds the cost of the articles to the unit. Under the guidance of Miss Dawlish, 40 women in our villages were given material to make 986 garments, which they sold to the unit for $714.45. More material has been purchased. Miss Baldwin reports that the library contains more than 700 volumes and now includes books for adults. An effort is being made to find the right person in each village to take charge of their circulation, most likely through the schools. At Greycourt, a house will shortly be opened at specified hours for a reading room, lending library, game room, and center for sewing classes, children's classes, and mothers' meetings. Another house is to be fitted as a workshop for the boys. A portable cinema machine has been purchased for the instruction and amusement of the children, who walk miles to see these pictures. An average of 320 children are being reached weekly through these channels, not counting the children reached through the creation of similar social centers in the villages of Canisy, Courcelles, and Verlaine. When reading the medical report, it should be remembered that since January 24th, there has been only one junior doctor at Greycourt, so the medical work has been greatly limited. Over the past month, with the assistance of one nurse, Miss Mills, Dr. Prine has made 364 house visits and received 160 patients in the dispensary for a total of 524. In the absence of our doctors, in serious cases we have the assistance of Dr. Stapleton of the American Red Cross Hospital at Nell, who holds dispensary at Greycourt 3 times a week, and also of Dr. Cooney of the AEF. Getting the proper pass from the British authorities for Dr. Clare and renewing the pass for Dr. Prine is of the highest priority for the ongoing success of the unit's mission. From a report by Miss Catherine Moran, class of 1911, assistant director to the Paris Committee, February 1918. February 1918. Paris, France. I would like to see the general, said Kate, for approximately the 23rd time.
Ce n'est pas possible, said the very minor official to whom Kate had progressed via a series of other minor officials. Monsieur le général only grants audiences on Saturday afternoons from 3:30 until 5, and on Wednesday mornings from 9 until 10:30.
It was Wednesday afternoon. The clock on the official's desk read 3:30. I was here at 9 in the morning, said Kate, channeling her fury into withering politeness. I was here before 9 in the morning. I was told I needed a pass to enter the building. I went to another office and acquired the pass. Then I was told I needed another pass to proceed up the stairs. That was 10:30. It has taken me 6.5 hours to get to this office, and I am not leaving. She spoke very slowly and clearly, just to make sure he understood. He didn't.
It is not the time at which Monsieur le Général receives visitors.
Well, he'll receive me, said Kate firmly. She fumbled in her pocket. Look, this is a letter of introduction from the Marquise de Noailles. Tell Monsieur le Général that the assistant director of Les Collégiens Américains is here to see him at the express request of the Marquise de Noailles.
Ah, Les Collégiens Américains.
He looked at her as though it explained a great deal, not necessarily in a good way, more in the way of suddenly being confronted with a zoo animal who might or might not bite.
One moment. Kate didn't wonder he looked at her strangely. She probably looked like a madwoman. She was wearing her uniform, the new one that Mrs. Barrett had brought for her, but it was slightly too large and already stained. Her red rubber boots, de rigueur for the mud of Grecor, were entirely out of place on the streets of Paris, and even more out of place on the elegant marble floor of the ministry. After 6 months of boots, it had never occurred to her to bring shoes. She'd practically forgotten what they were, or what it was to walk on solid flagstones instead of sinking knee-deep in mud. There was a chair in the anteroom, a spindly, gilded thing, so different from the stout wooden ones they'd been distributing to their villagers. Kate had been standing all day in one way or another, standing in line to get passes, standing in line to be admitted to the building, standing in line to be admitted to this office. She should sit, she knew, and muster her strength, but she was fizzing with nervous energy. It had been nearly a week since she'd been in Paris, and she hadn't accomplished a single thing she'd set out to do. It had been an unnerving and largely silent train ride with Julia, who was officially in Paris to get her pass renewed. When Kate had delicately tried to broach the question of whether the presence of Dr. Stapleton at Grecor might have something to do with her sudden desire to go to Paris, Julia had simply looked at her, one of her Medusa looks, designed to turn the unlucky into stone, and looked away again. It was a moot point anyway, Kate had told herself as they sat in stony silence for the rest of the journey, Julia's gigantic duffel bag wedged on the seat between them. As soon as Dr. Clare got her pass, they'd have no need for Dr. Stapleton, and therefore no need to discuss it. She and Julia had gone straight from the train to the hotel on the Quai Voltaire, which had become a sort of dormitory for the Smith unit in Paris. They'd found the new girls there. They looked disconcertingly clean. Clean and pressed and entirely unprepared. Had she looked like that once? Kate supposed she had, but it was hard to remember. Their nails were smooth and white, not jagged with the stains of earth under them that never quite came out. They wore clothes that hadn't been pounded by Marie, and their faces had a city smoothness to them, not windburn from months spent riding in an open truck with the wind and rain and snow howling through. They were, as Kate and the others had, volunteering with various charities while waiting for their passes to come through, making prosthetics and special shoes, both awed and alarmed by the proximity of Grecor to the war zone, full of questions about what had been done and what they were meant to do. "Is it true that you walked through a blizzard carrying 4 gallons of wine?" asked Miss Williams. "It wasn't wine," said Kate wearily. "It was milk. Milk from our cows. Milk needs to be delivered, even in the snow." "Thank goodness it's spring now," said Miss White, huddling into the shawl she had wrapped around her uniform jacket. "I can't bear the cold." "The weather has been much better." No need to tell them it was like Greenland at night, even in springtime. "And we've got plenty of blankets." "Were we ever that frivolous?" she asked Julia. They were sharing a room, a proper room. The dormitory, where Kate had stayed that first month, was being used for storage, bristling with things the various local Smith clubs had sent to the unit, waiting to be sorted. "They'll learn," said Julia, and put her pillow over her head to discourage further communication. It felt odd to be sleeping in a proper bed rather than a cot made of springs and sharp edges. Kate missed the slump and creak of it. She woke half a dozen times in the night at familiar but forgotten noises, the thrum of traffic, the sound of male voices. It was even worse leaving the hotel to run her errands. There were just so many people. The air felt different, warmer, stuffier, sootier. It felt wrong to be walking on pavement again instead of slogging through mud. The soot-stained buildings pressed too close around her. The air stank of assembled humanity instead of cows. Kate had never thought she would miss the cows.
"Kate!"
A large woman in a brown suit flung herself at Kate, nearly knocking her down.
"Liza!"
Kate couldn't believe how glad she was to see the other woman, even though it was odd to see her with her hair washed and done up properly, in a suit that was very much the wrong color for her complexion. I hardly recognized you in civvies. Liza plucked at her suit.
I hardly recognize me, she admitted. I never thought I'd miss the old uniform, but it does feel odd being out of it.
What are you doing in town? Maud joined them, dressed to the nines in the best the Paris shops could offer, looking Kate up and down in a way that Kate remembered well, as though she were sniffing out potential weaknesses. Reports and errands. Kate couldn't bring herself to say that Mrs. Barrett had mandated that she take a rest. I've promised fruit trees and chickens for Florence, and I want to see what I can do about getting Dr. Claire's pass expedited. Well, do try to enjoy yourself while you're here, said Maud patronizingly, before you have to go back to the wilds.
I do miss the cream from our cows, said Liza wistfully. In Paris, you can only get milk with a doctor's prescription. I've had to take my coffee black.
Yes, but you can get tickets to the opera, said Maud. She eyed Kate's headgear. And hats that haven't been gnawed by a goat. Kate grinned. Minerva sends you her love, too. Her love? She owes me a lace collar and two hats, said Maud indignantly. Bill it to the unit. Kate couldn't resist adding, You'd never know the place now. We're drowning in luxuries. Mrs. Barrett even found us a piano. They parted with insincere expressions of goodwill, but Kate found the meeting acted on her like a tonic. No matter how annoying Maud might be, she was somehow Kate's now, like a horrible cousin one couldn't disown. She didn't miss her, precisely, but she was strangely glad to see her and be annoyed by her again. Liza paused halfway down the block, said something to Maud, and came hurrying back.
I just wanted to say, if you need me, I can come back, you know. I had to get my pass renewed that time. Remember how they had the wrong name for me? So I did it when I was here getting my collarbone fixed, and the new one is good until April.
Are you sure? Asked Kate, touched despite herself. You were so looking forward to canteen work. Liza looked back over her shoulder at Maud, dropping her voice so she wouldn't be heard.
I miss Greycourt. I even miss the mud. It's dreadful being cooped up in a canteen instead of out there, getting about.
What about our boys? Kate asked. They'd heard a lot about our boys before Liza and Maud had left.
We're doing our best for them, but they don't seem to want awfully to be saved from temptation.
Liza sounded genuinely bewildered.
Oh dear, that's Maud calling. Give my love to the girls and the goats.
Kate watched Liza run off after Maud, thinking what a thoroughly decent person Liza was. If she'd been a little more patient, managed everything a little better, would Maud and Liza have stayed? It was only now that they'd gone that it was clear just how much they'd done for the unit, and Kate felt guilty for mocking them for decorating their barrack. She'd misjudged them horribly. She'd misjudged a lot of people, but mostly Emmy. If Emmy left the unit, she wasn't sure she could forgive herself for it. Julia had tried to tell her, but Kate had ignored her because Julia was Julia, and because, from the day they'd started Smith, she'd had an idea of what Emmy was, and she'd stuck to it, an idea compounded entirely of her own insecurities. She'd just assumed, she'd always assumed, that Emmy's name and position shielded her from everything, that being a Van Alden made her impervious, dancing obliviously through life, showering charity on lesser mortals. She'd wanted, if she were being honest with herself, to bring Emmy down a notch, to make her feel what it was to be small. Because Emmy's father belonged to private clubs, and Kate's had driven a wagon full of beer. But Kate's father had loved her. Her stepfather loved her. Even her ridiculous brothers loved her, when they weren't busy tormenting the life out of her. Her mother, who didn't approve of what she was doing, had come to see her off and sent her boots. And what did Emmy have? A mother who cared for everyone but her. A father who ignored her. A friend
who wasn't much of a friend at all. There was no point in going over it again and again, Kate told herself. She'd finish her errands, get back to Graycore as soon as Mrs. Barrett and the rail system would allow, and do her best to make up for the damage she'd done. In the meantime, she had fruit trees and chickens to acquire. Florence had told her to see the national nurseries about fruit trees, the next step in the grand replanting project. A very nice lieutenant received Kate cordially, offered her coffee, showed her their survey of the area, and told her it couldn't be done. Why not? Is it the cost? He'd shown her their maps of the region, estimating that to replace the fruit trees destroyed by the Germans in their villages would cost somewhere between $6,000 and $7,000. It was a sum that made Kate's stomach clench. But if there was one thing that she had learned in helping to run the unit, it was that sums that had seemed unthinkable to her were well within the reach of Smith's alumni.
You are too nearly front.
The lieutenant shrugged, an entirely French sort of shrug that Kate had learned translated to something in between c'est la guerre and why are you bothering me, you mad American?
It is too expensive to do the work twice. If we plant it now, the trees might be destroyed by shells. It is not worth the risk.
Nothing Kate could say would budge him. If she couldn't get Florence trees, she could at least find her chickens. The Marquise de Noailles, who had found them their goats, had provided Florence with the address of an official she swore could help them acquire poultry.
As many as you can get, Florence had told Kate. I could sell 300 or 400 if I could get them. They all need them so.
Which brought Kate to a very grand marble anteroom in a very grand marble ministry, waiting to see a very grand officer who only gave audiences on Saturday afternoons and Wednesday mornings. The assistant came out of the inner office and bowed to Kate.
Monsieur le Général will see you now.
Kate straightened her hat, which had, in fact, been lightly chewed by Minerva, she'd been hoping people wouldn't notice, and tried to look like someone who was regularly granted special audiences by important military officials. This office was the grandest of the many offices through which Kate had processed today. The desk was roughly the size of the SS Rochambeau, and the man who sat behind it was wearing a dazzling array of medals. He'd been so decorated that his medals had medals. Kate put her best rubber boot forward.
Thank you so much for being willing to see me. I'm only in Paris for another week.
The general rose in greeting.
We have heard of your good work in Graycore, mademoiselle.
He was very good. It took him only a second to consult her card.
Mademoiselle Morin, how may I be of assistance?
I've come about the chickens, said Kate succinctly.
Chickens?
He asked. Perhaps that had been a bit too succinct.
Madame la Marquise thought you might be able to tell us where we could buy chickens for our villagers.
I would be delighted to be able to oblige you, but...
Kate hadn't spent the past 6 months dealing with reluctant bureaucrats in Amiens and Noyon without learning that they always said that. There was always the but. The trick was getting in there before they could start making excuses.
I know they're very scarce right now, said Kate, quickly running through all possible answers to all possible objections. But we promise they will be put to the best possible use. There's no need to worry about the cost. We have the money to pay for them, and there won't be any bother with shipping. I will convey any chickens we might acquire personally to Graycore.
The general's mustache twitched in amusement.
You are, I see, a woman of great resources, and it breaks my heart to be unable to be of assistance, but you see, I know nothing about chickens.
But the Marquise said,
Madame la Marquise, I fear, has mistaken one fowl for another. My Provence, said the general,
unlocking a cabinet and proudly producing a brass bird,
is the carrier pigeon.
The carrier pigeon, said Kate.
A most noble bird, the pigeon,
said the general, patting his bronze pet.
Kate was fairly sure that most of the statues in Central Park might feel otherwise, but refrained from saying so. So you really know nothing about where I might find chickens?
Dommage, said the general. Now, about the pigeon.
The general waxed eloquent on the properties of pigeons and their use in warfare from the ancient Romans to the present. Kate managed to control herself throughout the recitation, thank the general kindly, apologize again for her mistake, and make it all the way out of the office, through the anteroom, and into the hall before covering her mouth with her handkerchief and giving way to a burst of hysterical laughter. She had spent a whole day wrangling passes and arguing with petty officials to hear a history of the pigeon. It was so dreadful it was funny, and she only wished Emmy were there, even if poultry was rather a tender subject with Emmy at present, but it was just the sort of thing Emmy would find irresistibly hilarious. Kate tried to share the joke with Julia, but Julia was not in a mood to be amused. Julia was braiding her long, golden hair for bed. She paused to look over her shoulder at Kate, saying abruptly, I was working with Dr. Clare at the Red Cross Hospital this morning, and I think you should know, Kate, she's not planning to come to Greycor. Kate sat on the edge of her bed, feeling the mattress sag beneath her. You mean she's waiting for her pass? Julia gave her head a brusque shake. I mean she's stopped trying to get a pass. She means to stay here. Suddenly, the brass pigeon didn't seem quite so funny. Fruit trees they could lose. Chickens might be had elsewhere, but they needed a senior doctor. There must be some mistake. Julia twisted a bit of ribbon around the end of her braid with brisk efficiency. If you say so. There wasn't any mistake. Dr. Clare wasn't staying at the hotel on the Quai Voltaire. She had made her own arrangements at the Hotel Sylvia. Kate caught her there the next morning at breakfast. Their new doctor had an apple-round face, a pair of spectacles on a gold chain, and the hardest brown eyes Kate had ever seen. She was delighted to make the acquaintance of the assistant director of the unit, even one so young, looked forward to seeing dear Mrs. Barrett again, and had absolutely no intention of going anywhere near the Somme. We're really most eager to have you at Greycor with us. It's heartbreaking the number of patients we've had to turn away, Kate tried, cupping her hands loosely around the lukewarm black coffee that had been offered her. It is a pity, but it is what it is, said Dr. Clare, not sounding as though she thought it was a pity at all. I have yet to be convinced that reconstruction work is either safe or worthwhile at present. Kate stared at her in surprise. Reconstruction was what they did. It was the entire mission of the unit. But you joined the unit. Your trunks are at Greycor. Do feel free to make what use you can of them, said Dr. Clare, with the air of someone making a great concession. We don't need 8 trunks of someone else's belongings. We need a doctor. Just in case Dr. Clare was missing the point, Kate added more insistently, You signed on to be our doctor. Our work is at Greycor. For the present, said Dr. Clare. There's every indication that the British will renew our passes, said Kate sharply, even though there was absolutely no indication. We intend to carry on with our work as planned, including our medical department, but for that, we need you. In Greycor. As to that, Dr. Clare seemed perfectly content to sit comfortably in her chair, her coffee in hand, as if she weren't ripping apart all Kate's plans, all the unit's plans, that was. When I enlisted, I had every intention of joining you at Greycor, and would have done so had my pass been issued. But Providence, it seems, is wiser than we. I truly believe that my work is here, with our fine boys. The only way to give France any lasting relief is to keep our troops fit and well. Worming French peasants will have to wait. They weren't peasants. They were people. They were their people. Kate made an effort to control her disgust.
You'd have worms, too, if you were living on a dirt floor, eating any manner of thing you could scrounge. Really, what can one expect of these people?
Dr. Claire seemed amused. Kate wanted to slap her.
I'm sure you girls can carry on bandaging cuts and bruises. The military situation seems to me far more important. After the war is time enough to do your relief work.
Your relief work, as if it weren't anything to do with her at all.
You signed a contract, Kate pointed out, trying to keep her voice level. We were relying on you to join us.
I can't very well join you without a pass, said Dr. Claire complacently.
It's more likely you'll soon be joining me. I'm sure the unit can do excellent work here in Paris.
That wasn't the point of the unit. It had never been the point of the unit. But there was clearly no arguing with her. Kate found herself desperately missing Dr. Stringfellow, who might pretend to be a misanthrope, but was always there when it mattered, and never balked at anything, not even hiking 5 miles through drifts with her medical bag on her back. Kate returned to the hotel in a state of deep agitation. She found Julia in the parlor, reading a medical journal.
Can you carry on without Dr. Claire? She asked without preamble. Julia didn't look up from her journal.
My pass expired, remember?
Kate stopped, struck by a sudden, nameless suspicion.
You've gone to get your pass renewed, haven't you?
I put in my request.
But Julia's hands didn't seem entirely steady as she turned the page of the Lancet. Kate stared down at Julia, thinking of that giant duffel bag.
You don't mean to go back, do you?
I can't if I don't have a pass, can I?
Kate was shaking. Her whole body felt like she had a fever, like Thanksgiving when she'd been so sick. But this wasn't a fever. It was rage and fear. Fear that everything was falling apart, that she'd ruined everything. She couldn't even keep the medical department running, much less anything else.
You're going to abandon us. You're going to let that cretin drive you away.
Julia wouldn't look at her. Kate's chest felt tight.
I'm right, aren't I? That's why you don't want to come back.
Deliberately, Julia closed her journal and stood, taking full advantage of every extra inch between them to look down at Kate.
What does it matter? The Brits are going to kick us out anyway. We're done, Kate. Admit it. There's no point in dragging it out.
Tossing her journal on the table, Julia stalked out, never once looking back. Chapter 22.
The British question is what absorbs all our minds these days. With the exception of 3 American women in the Philadelphia unit and 3 in the Red Cross Hospital at Nell, we know of no other British or American women in the part of the war zone controlled by the British. They're really quite strict on the topic. You ought to see the British officers marching by with their troops. It's quite remarkable. Long, clean cut, absolutely trim in appearance, well tailored, they stalk along at the head of their companies through miles of mud in the most casual way, as though they were out on a Sunday afternoon walk. It would never seem to occur to you that they had any idea of fighting. I believe they are said to go to battle in the same casual way. There are several affairs in the unit at present, but it's an awful place to have an affair with so little privacy and such an audience. Don't ask how I know. There's a British officer who has been making eyes at Emmy Van Alden, and for the sake of delicacy, we all have to pretend we know nothing about it, while all secretly hoping it might weigh the scales in our favor. Not that one is supposed to admit such things, but all's fair in l'amour et la guerre. Miss Eleanor Nell Baldwin, class of 1914, to her family. February 1918. Graycourt, France.
Colonel, Mrs. Barrett.
Emmy glanced at Captain DeWitt and found it wasn't quite in her power to form his name. Her lips just didn't seem to want to move in that direction. Emmy began backing toward the door.
I'm so sorry, I didn't realize we had visitors.
Very welcome visitors,
said Mrs. Barrett meaningfully. She looked at the colonel, who nodded. Colonel Hayes has just been telling us that we're to be allowed to stay. Emmy clasped her hands together, which at least gave her something to do with them. Otherwise, she suddenly seemed to have more arms than an octopus and at least half a dozen legs.
Oh, that's marvelous. Thank you.
She was trying very hard not to look at Captain DeWitt, which meant, of course, that she was alarmingly aware of his every infinitesimal movement. What did one say to someone who had kissed you 2 months ago? Well, it was a war, these things did happen, and then sent long, thoughtful letters entirely failing to mention said kiss or said war. Emmy wasn't sure what the protocol was for that. Neither the more traditional governesses approved by her father, nor the relentlessly progressive ones chosen by her mother, had covered those niceties in their tutelage. She could greet ambassadors in 3 languages, but she couldn't meet Captain DeWitt's eyes.
I don't know if you should be thanking me or cursing me, said Colonel Hayes briefly. I ought to have you out, but the French won't have it. I've been bombarded with visits from every petty official from here to Paris insisting that you be allowed to stay. Monsieur le Commandant Monin brought a book of newspaper clippings,
said Captain DeWitt, straight-faced, but Emmy could tell he was amused all the same.
He said if we evicted you, we would be worse than the Hun. Typical Frenchman, muttered Colonel Hayes.
He's been lovely, said Emmy, with feeling, possibly a little too much feeling. Everyone's been lovely. We're so very grateful. We are, of course, appreciative of your confidence in us, said Mrs. Barrett diplomatically. We should like, if possible, to remain another 6 to 8 months to see our work truly brought to fruition.
Fritz might have a thing or two to say about that, said Colonel Hayes. If you do stay...
We intend to do so, said Mrs. Barrett pleasantly. As you can see, we have a great deal of work in hand. Have we told you about our spring planting?
Colonel Hayes cleared his throat. Under the mustache, he was really fairly young, Emmy realized, and trying very hard to retain control of the situation.
As I was saying, if you do stay, there will be conditions.
Naturally, said Mrs. Barrett, which meant, Emmy knew, that she meant to persuade him out of all of them. Would you like more coffee, Colonel? Miss Van Alden, if you would be so kind as to ask Madame Gouge. Oh, yes, of course.
Emmy fumbled for the coffee pot, a rather pretty one, which Mrs. Barrett had brought with her from Paris.
Let me carry that for you,
said Captain DeWitt, and neatly scooped up the coffee pot before she could drop it. He held open the door for her with his other hand.
After you, Miss Van Alden.
There was really no need, said Emmy, as the door shut behind them. I spent the morning hauling bookshelves for Anne. I can manage a coffee pot.
I know you can.
Captain DeWitt paused on the path between the new house and the kitchen tent, which they were still using, despite Mrs. Barrett's determination to move the one working stove to the new house.
Don't you recognize a stratagem when you see one?
A stratagem? To abscond with the coffee?
It is very good coffee, but no.
Captain DeWitt looked at her over the coffee pot, the sunlight winking off the badge on his cap.
I mean to abscond with you, at least as far as the kitchen.
Emmy didn't seem to be breathing properly.
That isn't much of an... Is absconption a word?
I don't believe so,
said Captain DeWitt gravely. They stared at each other over the coffee pot, like strangers, but not. It had been 2 months since they had seen each other in person, 2 months since that bench by the moat. It was one thing to sit with someone at a party, flown on music and good food, and quite another to see them by day in one's official capacity, and wonder if he still saw whatever it was he had seen then, if he thought whatever it was of her he had thought then, or if it had just been Christmas and loneliness and the front and a sympathetic ear. Well, lips, really. The silence stretched between them, if it could truly be called silence, with artillery pounding in the distance and one of Emmy's roosters screeching.
It was so strange to be shy of each other when they'd been living inside each other's heads since Christmas. But there was a world of difference between being invited into the private world of someone's mind, all the odd thoughts and memories, and then presented once again with the living, breathing person in whom those thoughts resided, someone at once familiar and alien, and very, very much made of flesh. Emmy was strangely aware of the physicality of him, the way his uniform belted in at the waist, the breadth of his shoulders beneath the drab khaki, the ungloved hands holding the coffee pot.
"Or I can go away again," Captain DeWitt said, watching her very closely. "And write you a letter?"
Emmy flushed.
"That's an idea, isn't it? We could set up a post box somewhere between here and the house and leave each other letters in it. You know, things like, hello, and fine day, isn't it?"
"It is a fine day," agreed Captain DeWitt.
Emmy wished her uniform were cleaner, and that she'd washed her hair more recently.
"Thank you for letting us stay."
"It wasn't my decision."
The captain shifted the coffee pot from one hand to the other.
"The colonel really was driven half mad by Frenchmen petitioning him on your behalf."
Emmy couldn't help but feel flattered.
"On the unit's behalf, you mean?"
Captain DeWitt shook his head.
"Not just the unit, you. Your work in Corcelle is a shining model of what determination, hard work, and a warm heart can accomplish. I translate from the French, of course,"
he added dryly. There was something in his tone that made a little of the light fade from the sky.
"You sound as though you don't agree."
"I wish I didn't. If you were a dilettante or a hobbyist, it would be much easier to urge you to get out. The trouble is that what you're doing is making a difference."
He looked at her, his eyes shadowed by the brim of his cap.
"You know the children have a game they play. They call it Les Dames Américaines. The heroine of the game is called Mademoiselle Amy. That is what they call you, isn't it? Amy?"
"She who is beloved." Emmy gave an awkward sort of shrug.
"It's only because they can't pronounce Emmy. Please don't tell me the game is something awful."
"It's not if you're six. Someone lies down and pretends to be sick, and the others dance around and sing a song, and the Mademoiselle Amy character helps the first child up. It's a bit more than that, but that's the gist of it. I asked the little beasts what it was about. They said you were saving them."
Emmy blinked rapidly, trying not to show how close she was to tears.
"All I did was get them milk and a village pump.
And blankets, and beds, and shoes, and clothes. They appreciate it, you know. We just marched through, but you stopped for them. Half those children would have died this winter without you. Don't tell me I'm exaggerating, I'm not. You've done the hardest part. You've kept them going through winter. But winter is over. And the sooner you get out, the better."
"But there's still so much left to do. It's not just winter."
Emmy looked at him appealingly, trying to make him understand.
"There's still the rest of the planting. We've done a first round of distributions for basic needs, but that's only the beginning. We need to canvass everyone again and find out what else they need, and that takes time. It all takes time."
"Time is what you don't have."
Captain DeWitt lowered his voice, looking over his shoulder.
"There's going to be fighting. You must have heard talk, haven't you?"
"There's always talk."
He was standing so close that she could see the insignia on his buttons.
"We thought we were going to be shelled out at least a dozen times since we arrived, and we're still here."
"It's not like that this time. There have been rumblings across the line. There are trucks coming in from the east, trucks and men. We've caught the Germans studying our lines. They're planning something, and whatever it is, it's going to happen soon. We have plans in place to try to stave them off, but I shouldn't be telling you any of this."
"No, you shouldn't."
Emmy looked quizzically at him.
"Your colonel did say the unit could stay."
Captain DeWitt made a noise of frustration.
"It's not the unit I'm concerned about. It's you. I was half hoping you'd all be out. that I could know you were safely in Paris on your way back to the States, anywhere but here.
Because I can't be trusted to take care of myself?
Because the Germans can't be trusted not to shoot everyone on sight,
Captain DeWitt said roughly.
Do you think they'll care that you're only here to help, or that you're American rather than French? You're at war now, too. I can't tell you to go. I haven't the right to tell you to go, but there are nights when I wake up in a cold sweat, dreaming the Germans have come, and you're here in their path. There's no protection for you here, nothing.
Only you, said Emmy, looking up at Captain DeWitt, at his weathered, worried face. You stand between us and them.
I wish we were equal to that trust. Oh, don't think we won't do our damnedest. We will. But numbers tell in the end. It doesn't matter how pure your heart is, no matter what the poets say.
Are you trying to scare me? Emmy asked seriously. It was hard to reconcile this talk of death with the sun shining down, with the smell of springtime in the air, with Zélie chasing Minerva across the lawn, trying to get back someone's winter underclothes.
Would it work if I did?
Captain DeWitt asked hopefully.
I'm not going, Emmy said. She hadn't even realized she'd made her decision until she said it. I made a promise to the people here and to the unit. I can't just run away to save my own skin.
I know,
Captain DeWitt said soberly.
You have your duties and I have mine, and it's entirely beside the point that I want you to live. I want us both to live, preferably together. If you could bring yourself to have me, if this war ever ends.
Emmy, have you seen Minerva?
It was Florence, coming down the path, shielding her eyes from the sun.
She went that way, said Emmy, pointing, and turned back to Captain DeWitt, who was looking quite uncomfortable and more than a little embarrassed. Did you just propose to me?
No,
he winced.
Possibly. Could we say I'm proposing to propose? I can't propose to you like this. I'm holding a coffee pot.
It's a very nice coffee pot, said Emmy.
Captain DeWitt grimaced at the item in question.
Never mind the coffee pot. That's the least of it. If something happens, when something happens, I don't want you tied to a man with no legs or no face. It would be one thing to be killed outright, but you were there at the hospital at Neuilly. You know what the odds are.
You know that wouldn't matter to me.
Everything felt very unreal. Any moment now, she'd find she wasn't here at all, on the path with Captain DeWitt, but on her cot in the barrack, with Florence shaking her awake. Emmy squinted up at Captain DeWitt, trying to read his expression. Tentatively, she said,
But you can't really want to propose, or propose to propose.
Captain DeWitt looked down at her, his expression very serious.
Are you going to tell me we hardly know each other? I've known people for years I haven't known nearly so well as I've known you in 6 months.
It's closer to 7, actually. Not that I've been counting,
Emmy added hastily.
I don't want to deceive you. I'm really rather dull when I'm not in a uniform.
His lips quirked in a crooked smile.
I used to collect stamps when I was a boy. Not because they were valuable, but because I liked thinking about where they'd come from and where they might go. But the truth is, I probably won't go much of anywhere. I'd thought of it once, of roaming the world and going to the edges of the map, where the sea serpents stand sentinel. But I like my home too much, and my family.
He'd written to her about them all. About his sister at Somerville College, his little brother at Harrow, about the model village they were building for their biscuit factory workers, or had been, before the war.
It's a good thing to like one's family, said Emmy seriously.
She loved her brothers, but she wasn't sure that anyone in her family liked each other terribly much.
I used to do the same, not with stamps, but with maps. I used to steal the atlases from my father's library and imagine myself away, anywhere but where I was.
Would a small village in Durham be far away enough for you? If it helps,
he said diffidently,
We have turrets and gargoyles. My grandfather built a faux medieval monstrosity, complete with leaded windows and a priest's hall. We even have a secret passage, though I'm not sure it precisely counts as secret when everyone knows exactly where it goes.
There was nothing Emmy would like better, wandering through a not-so-secret passageway with... And there was the problem.
Do you realize I still don't know your first name?
What's in a name?
Captain DeWitt caught himself.
Never mind, Romeo isn't an example we want to be following.
That was Juliet.
Emmy looked up at him, remembering a long-ago conversation in a Salvation Army canteen, what felt like roughly a decade ago.
You did promise not to descend to Shakespeare.
I did, didn't I?
He looked at her in a way that made the world around them fade into nothing. No chickens, no trucks, no colonel waiting for coffee. There was nothing in the world but the two of them, here, on this scrap of duck walk in the midst of the spring mud.
It's Fitzwilliam. My friends call me Will.
That's not nearly so bad as Algernon, said Emmy softly, unable to look away.
I'm glad it passes muster. You wouldn't mind seeing it on your stationery, then? At some point,
Captain DeWitt added,
my father will shuffle off this mortal coil and you'll be lumbered with a lady in front of your name, but hopefully not for quite some time. He's a good old stick, and I rather like him. I think you would, too.
Emmy hated to say it. She hated to even think it. But someone had to.
Haven't you stopped to think? We're in the midst of a war zone. There aren't any other women within miles. You might change your mind when you get home. You might decide you'd rather not be saddled with an overgrown do-gooder with buck teeth. And an American, she added as an afterthought.
You'd be surprised how many Americans there are in London. Lady Randolph Churchill, for one. You'll fit right in. More to the point, what idiot told you you're overgrown?
He demanded, sounding every inch the outraged English lordling.
You're just the right height.
For getting things off high shelves?
Emmy couldn't help herself. She always spouted nonsense when she was nervous.
No,
he said firmly, looking at her in a way that proved just how well-matched they were in height. In her thick-heeled rubber boots, they were practically nose-to-nose and lip-to-lip. He brushed a strand of stray hair out of her face, his hand cupping her cheek.
For this.
Don't mind me.
They jolted apart as Nell brushed past them.
Dave's ditched the Red Cross truck at the gate again. Marie is threatening bodily harm.
Captain DeWitt pressed the heel of his hand against his eye.
Good Lord, it's like Euston Station. Is there any privacy?
Not much.
Emmy fought a disconcerting tendency to giggle. They'd gone from romance to farce, but bizarrely, that made her feel better. It made it more real somehow. More something that might actually happen to her instead of a woman out of a book.
Come on, we'd best go get the coffee.
She took his arm, and it felt entirely natural to do so, to walk down the duck walk together with the sun shining on their heads. Captain DeWitt, Will, she reminded herself, looked sideways at her.
They'll all be talking about us now, won't they?
They already were,
Emmy admitted, smiling despite herself.
We live in very close quarters here. It gives us something to talk about other than the war. Nell has been sneaking behind the barracks with one of the engineers, and Florence has been walking out with a Canadian forester who doesn't seem to mind that she hasn't washed her hair since Christmas. She says it helps to keep warm. Oh, and Gwen Mills thinks we don't know that she's been exchanging letters with one of the doctors at the Red Cross Hospital.
Emmy.
Will stopped her before she could lift the flap of the kitchen tent.
You do know, don't you, that this isn't just a wartime infatuation. This isn't your friend and the forester, or stealing kisses behind the barracks.
Behind the barracks, Emmy thought, would be a much safer place than the duck walk. She was rather sorry they hadn't thought of it. Because if this was a wartime infatuation, well, maybe it made her a hussy or a fallen woman, but she'd rather have all the memories she could have to take home with her once it was over.
Will tried to take her hands and remembered he was holding the coffee pot. Before the war, when life was an endless garden party and the worst that might happen was tea gone tepid, I made the usual rounds of Saturday to Monday and did my duty at the requisite number of debutante dances. I've met any number of women I'm happy to esteem as friends, but never anyone I wanted to share a breakfast table with for the rest of my life.
Before Emmy could say anything, he added firmly,
"That's not the trenches speaking, or the loneliness or delusion brought on by tainted food. That's you, because you're like no one else in the world, and if the world had to come to this for me to find you, maybe the Kaiser isn't all that bad after all."
"I really don't think you should be saying that,"
said Emmy, in a voice that didn't sound like her own.
"Doesn't that count as treason?"
"All right, we won't invite the Kaiser to the wedding," said Will, his breath warm against her lips.
"That's idiot of a Red Cross truck driver."
Emmy jumped roughly a foot in the air as Madame Gouja stomped up to them.
"Pardon me, that man just makes me so angry. Did you want something?"
"Yes, some privacy," muttered Will in English.
Emmy took the coffee pot from her would-be lover's hand. She had very fond feelings about that coffee pot at present. She had very fond feelings about everything, but particularly the very annoyed Englishman standing next to her. Demurely, Emmy handed the coffee pot to Madame Gouja.
"Mrs. Barrett wanted a fresh pot of coffee for Colonel Hayes, and possibly a few biscuits."
Chapter 23.
"I want another month, perhaps two, to make sure the unit is so firmly fixed in public opinion that no one could possibly contemplate sending them home again, or breaking them up into smaller groups and farming them out for canteen work, as the Red Cross is now threatening to do. We are, as you may have heard, now officially under the control of the Red Cross. Ruth Barrett is an expert politician, and I believe equal to the task of making the Red Cross think they're in charge while going on doing exactly what she wants to do. I just wish I knew for sure that what she wants to do is what I would like her to do. It is particularly annoying having to run an organization through other people. They persist in having opinions of their own, and those are not always what one would want those opinions to be. I have hopes of Kate Moran, but she's young yet and wants steadying. Give the girls my love and tell them I'll be home as soon as I may. I miss you all terribly."
Mrs. Ambrose Rutherford, née Betsy Hayes, class of 1896, former director, to her husband, Ambrose Rutherford, Esquire. March 1918. Paris, France.
"You look like you need a biscuit," said Mrs. Rutherford.
Kate sat down gingerly on a silk-covered chair. Mrs. Rutherford was staying in a very grand house in the Faubourg Saint-Germain, the sort with ceilings higher than the heavens, windows that went on forever, and wall panels edged in gilt. Mrs. Rutherford's battered suit, with its sagging skirt and pouching pockets, was decidedly incongruous next to all the ormolu and marquetry.
"I think you're confusing me with Liza."
"Nonsense," said Mrs. Rutherford, rummaging in a large box and pulling out a battered packet of DeWitt's rich tea biscuits.
"I couldn't possibly confuse you with anyone."
There was something reassuringly mundane about that crumpled pack of cookies. The same couldn't be said of the Greek gods holding court on the painted ceiling.
"This is quite the place."
"It's on loan from an acquaintance. Cheaper than staying at a hotel," Mrs. Rutherford added, handing Kate a biscuit. "This way I can contribute my hotel fees to the unit."
She'd been here in Paris all this time, donating money, chivying reporters. But she'd left them on their own on one day's notice.
"Why did you let them make you go?"
It wasn't what Kate had come to ask, but now that the question was out, she couldn't stop.
"If you're still here, doing all this, why didn't you stay?"
Mrs. Rutherford hesitated over two identical biscuits. She finally picked one.
You know that I was asked to resign.
Yes, but did you really have to listen?
There they had been, blundering their way along, freezing in barracks, desperately needing someone to give them guidance, while Mrs. Rutherford had been here, in this palace that looked like something out of the court of Louis XIV.
Or did you just not want to be there anymore?
Oh, my dear, said Mrs. Rutherford, which was somehow nearly as infuriating as the room itself. Do you really think I would leave you all just when we'd finally arrived?
But you did.
Kate felt like a child. All those hard months, all the desperation and having to be resourceful, all the trying and feeling like she was always failing, every small victory followed by a new setback rushed in on her, making her feel lightheaded and close to tears.
I didn't want to go. I wasn't left much choice.
Mrs. Rutherford toyed with the handle of the coffee pot. Like the rest of the items in the room, it was a museum piece, whisper-thin Limoges, a world away from the thick red-and-white pottery of Graycore.
I've had some hiccups in my past.
Hiccups? Kate frowned at their former director. Hiccups seemed unnecessarily frivolous.
Peccadillos might be the better word.
Mrs. Rutherford looked up at Kate over the coffee pot.
Not everyone approves of women making their own way, and that includes some Smith women. My archaeological career has been a cause, in the past, for some raised brows.
Kate's cookie tasted like ash.
You were who you were when you founded the unit. That didn't stop anyone then.
You can't put anything past a Smith woman, said Mrs. Rutherford ruefully. We train you all far too rigorously. More sloppy habits of mind might be a boon in certain circumstances. You may have heard that I was caught in Greece during the Greco-Turkish War.
Kate eyed Mrs. Rutherford warily.
I heard you were decorated by the Queen of Greece for your bravery.
She's a wonderful woman, Queen Olga. I was.
Mrs. Rutherford sat up a little straighter, folding her hands in her lap. She looked directly at Kate.
And then I spent 6 months in a sanatorium in Switzerland recovering.
There was something about the way she said it.
For your health?
I was not myself. The things I had seen, well, I don't need to tell you. It was deemed prudent that I undertake a rest cure.
Mrs. Rutherford's back was very straight, but the corners of her mouth trembled slightly before she got herself back under perfect control. Kate squirmed uncomfortably on her chair.
Surely no one could hold that against you.
Not that alone, perhaps.
Mrs. Rutherford took a deep breath.
But there were other incidents. After my daughter was born, I was not in the easiest state of mind. I forgot things. I forgot my daughter. I left her in a stationery shop in Northampton. I got her back again, she added. She was entirely unscathed. She had a lovely hour being cooed at by the staff in the shop. But it's the sort of thing that gets around.
That hardly seems, Kate began.
Oh, there was more.
Mrs. Rutherford crunched down hard on a biscuit.
I thought I could get through it by just carrying on, by working my way through the fog. I was teaching a class at Smith. There were days I couldn't get out of bed to come to class at all, and when I did, I cried all the time. I could never tell when it would come on. My students started bringing extra handkerchiefs to class. It became a great joke with the students. But they weren't terribly amused when I went to administer the final examination and found I had left all the examination papers at home.
You were that, Professor?
Even Kate had heard the stories. It was a legend on campus, the batty classics professor, or possibly a botany professor, or maybe even a French professor.
Yes, said Mrs. Rutherford resignedly. I was that professor. People talked, of course. There were requests that I resign.
But you didn't.
Not that time, but that was different. That wasn't the fate of 2,000 innocent people.
Mrs. Rutherford drew in a deep breath.
That's what you're really asking me, isn't it? Why I didn't fight to stay. I didn't fight to stay because I knew if I did, it would tear the unit apart, or at least discredit our mission beyond repair. I had never imagined anyone would dredge up all that. It had been so long. But once they did, who wants a mission run by a woman society is condemned as unstable? That's what they were saying, you know. That I was mad. That I had always been mad. That I couldn't be trusted to make decisions.
It was hard to look at her, to hear the naked pain in her voice.
Everything we had done, all of our plans, they were all in danger of being dismissed as the ravings of a lunatic mind. And who knows, she added whimsically. Perhaps they're right. In ancient Greece, there was a fine line between inspiration and madness. The sacred prophets speak truth and then run mad. Biscuit.
No, thank you, said Kate. She was still holding the first one. It was gummy and slightly crumbly in her hand. You aren't trying to alarm me, are you?
Perhaps just a little. But you see the problem.
Kate could only nod. There had been a time or two, she remembered guiltily, when she had wondered if Mrs. Rutherford, with her enthusiasms, her sweeping ideas, was entirely sane. Those whom the gods touched, indeed.
So you see, said Mrs. Rutherford, I had no choice. The only thing I could do was ensure that I left the unit in good hands.
Dr. Stringfellow?
No, I mean you. I fought for you, you know. I made it a condition of my going that you take on the baton, under Ava, of course.
But why? We'd barely just arrived. I hadn't even been sure about coming in the first place.
Because I'm a very good judge of character, said Mrs. Rutherford complacently. And because you made Madame find us all space at the hotel.
Anyone would have.
No, they wouldn't. They'd have scattered to a dozen other hostelries and broken up the unit before it even started.
Kate opened her mouth to argue, and then closed it again. It was true. But even if Mrs. Rutherford was right about that, she was wrong about the rest of it.
I managed the hotel, Kate said, feeling her voice catch. But that may have been the only thing I did right. We barely made it through the winter. So many members of the unit have resigned, and Mrs. Barrett seems to think we need improvements.
You made it through the winter. Barely or not, you did. You kept the unit there and working.
Did you think it was a foregone conclusion?
It wasn't.
But the resignations. Mrs. Rutherford waved that aside.
Maude Randolph and Ethel Ledbetter were going to resign after 6 months anyway. There was never any question of that. Where Maude goes, Liza goes. It's an inalterable law of nature and nothing to do with you. And Margaret Cooper was on my head.
Mrs. Rutherford's face sobered.
I should have seen from the beginning that she wasn't up to the work. Ruth Barrett has suggested evaluating more stringently for both physical and mental fitness, and she's right.
She's come in and changed everything, said Kate in a low voice. Pianos and maids and new schedules. I really did try to do my best for the unit.
Did?
Mrs. Rutherford sat up very straight, peering at Kate as though Kate were a particularly naughty Greek inscription.
The unit still needs you. It needs you and Ruth. Hear me out. Ruth Barrett may seem frivolous, but she's a brilliant diplomat. She'll do what's needed to butter up the Brits and keep the Red Cross happy without letting them eat us whole. But she doesn't have the sheer, dogged determination to wrangle the unit forward. That's you. You're the one who holds it all together.
Kate thought of Emmy, who hadn't quite yet tendered her resignation, but might. She thought of Julia, hiding from Dr. Stapleton.
I wouldn't say that, she said hoarsely. I've upset more people.
You can't let that bother you, said Mrs. Rutherford. Not if you want to get anything done.
If you want to be loved, don't take on responsibility. But you can't do that, can you? I've seen you. Your natural tendency is to lead, and to lead is to upset people. That's just what it is. What if you hurt people you care about? To love is to forgive. I should know. I've been forgiven more times than I can count. Ava, for one, but that's not a story you need to hear. Mrs. Rutherford looked at her with a sisterly sort of compassion. It's one of the great lessons I've learned over years of blundering gloriously. True friendship isn't abstaining from hurting one another, but forgiving each other when you do.
You make it sound so simple, said Kate helplessly.
Do I? It's really quite the opposite. We're all such masses of contradictions. We can barely understand ourselves, much less anyone else. And the more we care about someone, the more we have the capacity to wound them.
Recalling herself to the present, Mrs. Rutherford smiled determinedly at Kate.
You can blame me if you like. I put a great deal on you when I chose you, but it was because I knew you capable of it. And you're still capable of it.
Kate shook her head, wishing she could see herself as Mrs. Rutherford saw her.
I can't even get Florence her chickens.
That, said Mrs. Rutherford, is something I can solve. Bruised spirits are beyond my control, but poultry I can provide. Where did I put that pencil?
The audience was over. Mrs. Rutherford provided Kate with a slip of paper with yet another address on it, told her not to mope, and chivied her firmly toward the door.
Thank you for the biscuit, said Kate, and the address.
Mrs. Rutherford looked at Kate thoughtfully.
Do you remember the story of the ox cart of the kings of Phrygia?
It took Kate a moment to remember what she was talking about.
You mean the Gordian knot?
Closing her eyes, she recited what she could remember.
It was impossibly knotted, and no one could figure out how to untie it, so Alexander the Great came along and sliced it open.
In some versions of the story, he pulls out the linchpin of the ox cart to free the rope, but slicing has far more elan.
Mrs. Rutherford rested her hands on Kate's shoulders, looking deeply into her eyes.
You, Miss Moran, have a remarkable capacity for slicing knots. Don't be afraid to draw your sword. Now go away and get on with the work that needs to be done.
Kate was left staring at the beautiful wooden panels of the door, thoroughly bemused. She'd forgotten Mrs. Rutherford's force of character. Mesmerism had nothing on it. The ox cart of the kings of Phrygia, indeed. But it certainly had worked so far, this cutting of knots. Everything they'd accomplished had come of ignoring the official channels through which they were meant to do things, and just going ahead and doing them, aggravating Red Cross officials and inflicting French bureaucrats with permanent dyspepsia. Go away and get on with the work that needs to be done. It wasn't a very elegant motto, but it was a functional one. Feeling a little giddy, Kate wondered if it sounded any better in Latin, or possibly ancient Greek. In the spirit of knot cutting, she marched to the address Mrs. Rutherford had given her, and after a mere 2 days of being sent from office to office to office, she emerged triumphant with 3 crates of fancy fowl.
Does that mean chickens? Kate asked suspiciously.
I am only interested in chickens, not roosters or any other kind of poultry that is not a chicken. Would Mademoiselle like to see them lay eggs? The harassed seller asked.
Your word is sufficient, Kate said, staring at him in a way that completely unnerved him and lowered the price by a good 10 francs. Buoyed by her success, she breezed past Madame at the hotel, or at least as much as one could breeze while juggling 3 crates of squawking fowl, inexpertly roped together with twine, and thumped the chickens down next to Julia's bed. Julia was propped against the pillows, reading a newspaper.
Pack your things, said Kate briefly. We're going back to Greycourt. Are you talking to me or the chickens? Asked Julia.
You.
The chickens have no choice in the matter. Do you mean to put me in a crate? Julia raised herself up on her elbows.
You're not serious, are you?
I have no pass, remember? Kate stuffed 3 clean shirt waists into her duffel.
When did we ever let that stop us? Remember when you talked Liza through the checkpoint with that article from whichever paper it was?
For a moment, Julia seemed to be listening, but then she lowered herself back against the pillows.
We won't be able to bluff our way through with Le Monde Illustré this time. They've tightened the restrictions. We'll find a way.
Setting down her duffel, Kate marched up to the side of the bed, folding her arms across her chest.
I will not let that Stapleton man drive you out. I don't care what I need to do. I'll trust him and fling him into no man's land myself if that's what it takes.
He's a foot taller than you are.
So is that poilu I punched, said Kate dismissively. Height isn't everything.
Julia lifted her head.
You punched a poilu? I'll tell you about it on the train.
Kate tossed Julia's uniform jacket in the other woman's general direction.
You've been lying around all week, and it's a terrible waste. I won't have it.
You won't have it.
I'm still assistant director, said Kate firmly. If you don't pack, I'll pack for you.
Someone is feeling autocratic today, commented Julia bitingly. You do realize that assistant director is not the same as Lord High Tyrant.
That's assistant Lord High Tyrant.
Kate paused in her packing and looked at Julia, who seemed more awake than she had for days. Julia was another one of those people who didn't do well when she wasn't busy.
I don't blame you for not wanting to be in the same room with Dr. Stapleton. That's none of your concern.
Julia's face was very white, her cheekbones very pronounced.
But it is.
Sheer, dogged determination, Mrs. Rutherford had said. That was what Kate brought to the unit. And something else as well.
Not just because we desperately need a doctor, and you're a very good one, although we do, and you are, but because we're a unit, we stand together. If that man tries to hurt you, any one of us will tear out his guts.
There was a long pause before Julia said,
You realize that's not as easy as it sounds. You can't just go around casually disemboweling people.
I'm not feeling the least bit casual about it. Once, she might have thought Julia was just being standoffish, but now she knew better. She wouldn't let Julia down the way she'd let down Emmy.
You're not alone anymore. Your mother may have disowned you, but you've got all of us.
Kate saw Julia blink rapidly before turning away and saying, in a deliberately bored voice,
Just what I needed, a swarm of ill-assorted sisters.
We could say cousins, if you'd rather be more distantly related. Kate seized on the excuse to change the topic.
Speaking of cousins, that's another reason to go back. I'm concerned about yours. She's been getting letters from that British captain.
Are you afraid she'll suffer a paper cut? Kate swept her hairbrush, hair receiver, and book of hairpins into her bag.
I'm afraid she'll suffer something. You know how impressionable Emmy can be. He's so, well, British. And he has a highly dubious mustache.
A dubious mustache? Julia's blonde brows rose. Put that way, it did sound rather ridiculous. But Julia was looking more human than she had in weeks.
Look, are you coming or not? Kate demanded.
Julia swung her legs off the side of the bed, moving reluctantly, but moving all the same.
We're going to be sent back, you know. You never know until you try, said Kate, shoving Julia's jacket at her. Do you remember the story of the Kings of Phrygia's ox cart?